Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen podcast, the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome culinary historian Ken Albala. In today's episode, we're going to talk to Ken about jelly, his new book, The Great Gelatin Revival, and we'll hear Ken's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. If you're like me, you have squeamish memories of off-putting Jell-O molds or Jell-O salad from the 70s and 80s. But gelatin has a long history and is elemental to cooking as butter or flour. Julia has almost a dozen recipes for dishes in Aspect, in Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and several more in Volume 2. She devoted Episode 22 of The French Chef to Aspect. And in the introduction to the companion chapter in The French Chef Cookbook, Julia says this: "There is nothing like aspic to dress up a cold duck or a poached egg. It will turn either one into an object of incomparable and glittering chic." Really, Julia? Julia sounds downright smitten with gelatin, and she makes no excuses, nor does she change her tune 25 years later when she writes The Way to Cook, which includes a 2-page spread for Mediterranean fish and aspic, replete with color photo. Why? Because learning to make aspic and cook with gelatin is fundamental to French cooking. It's not weird or esoteric, but a foundational skill trained cooks learn from day one. Someone who understands just how evergreen gelatin is to the way we eat, and he knows his aspics from his gelées, is Ken Albala. Ken is the Tully Knowles Endowed Professor of History at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. Both a prolific and widely respected culinary historian, Ken has published 27 books, including academic monographs, single-subject food histories, reference works, and translations. His Beans of History won the IACP Jane Grixon Award for Food Writing, and Three World Cuisines won the Gourmand International Best Foreign Cuisine Book in the World. He was series editor for several food series, managing over 100 titles, and co-editor of Food, Culture, and Society. He is a trustee of the Oxford Food Symposium and a fellow of the Association for the Study of Food and Society. You can conclude he knows his food history. Inspired by an invitation daring him to create a dish by the popular Facebook group Show Me Your Aspics, really a popular Facebook group, Ken went deep down the gelatin rabbit hole, eventually leading to writing his latest book, The Great Gelatin Revival: Savory Aspics, Jiggly Shots, and Outrageous Desserts. replete with dozens of recipes covering vegetables and salads, seafood, meat and poultry, dairy and eggs, fruit, and a miscellany chapter called Outrageous Combinations, Ken examines gelatin's ever-changing fortunes and wondrous constructions. He joins us today to talk jelly and tell us whether we're bringing aspic back. Welcome to the podcast, Ken.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
We're delighted to have you. I think this is going to be really fun. But let's start with you. How on earth did you get so obsessed with gelatin?
Well, I wasn't really obsessed. In fact, I never ate it my whole life. I was kind of horrified by it, just like everyone else who grew up in the 60s and 70s. My mother made these horrible dietetic, multicolored, layered jello concoctions. And I feigned abhorrence one day, having claimed that I learned where gelatin comes from. So I really never touched the stuff at all. And the first time I did was just a few years ago when someone, as you said, dared me to look at this Facebook page. And I kind of thought, well, let me give it a shot. Let me just make a jello for fun. And what I did, which is very unlike, using a jello packet, is took a really interesting cocktail, added gelatin to it, and a couple of interesting ingredients to make it savory. And I thought, why aren't people doing this? Why are they, A, either going to the very high end of very difficult, fancy, classical French aspics, or just using the jello packets, which are pre-flavored and artificially colored and really not so interesting? So it was kind of a revelation by pure accident that I got into jello.
Yeah, and I feel like one way gelatin's come back, which is in sort of into popular parlance or home cooking, is that you see cooks use it a lot on cooking competition shows to make their dessert, which I think one key reason is you can make a fancy dessert faster than other options. But do you think that's been a part of it, or is that really a reflection of what was going on in sort of dining tastes in the outside world?
Well, I don't think it was popular in high fashion, high-end restaurants at all, really since the mid-20th century. I don't think you'd ever see it on a nice-looking restaurant, or you'd never see it in a recipe in a cookbook. It went thoroughly, utterly out of fashion for reasons that I think have a lot to do with people wanting whole food and natural food and sustainable, organic, whatever it may be. And gelatin is exactly the opposite. Even though it is actually a natural food, it comes from, collagen and bones and connective tissue. But I think in people's minds, it looks like the most artificial of foods. So historically, you see in periods where people want to be creative and use bright colors and perfumes and interesting arrangements and put extraneous ingredients together. In fact, periods where they trust science, and especially science applied to food, those periods love Jell-O. Mid-20th century, the Victorian era, late Middle Ages and Renaissance, it turns out, also is a really, really big time for gelatin. And those periods where they look to natural food, I would say the 17th century by and large, and I'd say the early 20th century, and of course, the era that we're in right now, gelatin really just looks, it looks silly. And it's almost like if you serve it, it's for kitsch value. You kind of laugh at it and go, ha-ha, can you believe the perverse things that our parents made? Wasn't that disgusting? And you laugh at it. But I think that's going to change. I think it's something that we are beginning to trust science again in the kitchen, not in the sort of high-end way that molecular gastronomy did, although that I think has been passé for a long time now, really, but in a way that we accept lab-grown meat, things that are very, very highly engineered. And I think that along with that, gelatin is going to have a comeback. It's happened before. This is just, it's not just a random prediction that I'd like it to come back. I think it has seen these surges in popularity alternating with periods where it was just reviled. And people really, nowadays, I think most people find it kind of disgusting.
Well, yes, I was doing a medical procedure and I couldn't eat for 24 hours. And the one thing you could eat was Jell-O, which it said, and you could only eat certain colors of it. And I bought it and it was just, did not make me think, oh, what have I been missing?
I was like, okay. I don't get why the association with hospitals. I mean, gelatin is not very nutritious. And certainly the stuff that has sugar and flavoring and coloring in it, that's not really good for you. So I don't, that association makes no sense. Neither.
I think really it's just that it's easy to digest, that it just goes right through you. But actually, on that note, I think before we get farther, can you just give us a quick primer on the differences between what aspic is, what gelatin, they're all related, obviously, but what is aspic, sure, what is gelatin, and what is jello?
Well, gelatin is sort of the umbrella term that covers any hydrocolloidal suspension that's reversible. I know that sounds like really scientific explanation, but it just means that you can melt the connective tissue in any animal. It could be, you know, usually it comes from pigs or beef, but chicken feet make a great gelatin. So does hartshorn, the antlers on deer. So does sturgeon, a swim bladder of sturgeon, which is called isinglass, can also make a really good gelatin. Those are all gelatins. An aspic is specifically when you suspend ingredients in it, and ideally you want it to be clear and, you know, be able to see them and unmold it and have this wonderful presentation piece. So an aspic just means things stuck in your jello. But jello itself, J-E-L-L-O, is the brand name. It's just become a generic term for gelatin in the United States, whereas in Europe, England especially, they use the term jelly, which, if you say that to a person in the United States, we think pectin, you know, like a jellied strawberry jelly or something like that.
Which is
totally different.
Great jelly.
Right. And I think our use of the term is much more specific. It's good that we say jelly, we mean one thing. We say gelatin, we mean something else. But there are also vegetable gelatins. I mean, there's like, you know, agar-agar and carrageenan and actually even starch, you know, can make a kind of suspension like that. They don't jiggle, which I find disappointing. But otherwise, you know, if you're vegetarian.
Only animal-based ones have the jiggling property.
Right. And only they, you know, when you like sort of bite down on gelatin, it sort of yields and then it shears very quickly. And so it's really pleasant to chew on.
So you say, but
with
jello, just to be, is it made from the same ingredients or is jello entirely artificial?
No, it's totally gelatin, but it's flavoring and coloring and, you know, it's just not that tasty. It's like eating
candy.
So
like the gelatin part of it is natural. It's all the other parts of it that are much more artificial.
Exactly. And theoretically you could make natural, you know, gelatin. You just take gelatin powder that's unflavored, add whatever natural flavors you want. So I, you know, in this book, I never used the brand Jell-O. I just saw no real reason to do that. And things that you would think were kind of grotesque, like, you know, Jell-O salads. Well, I think if you make them with lime flavored Jell-O and add mayonnaise and sour cream and things like that, you're going to get something really horrid. But if you take an ordinary salad and put it in like a glass of really nice crisp Riesling, it's magnificent, or Sauvignon Blanc, once it becomes gelatinized, I think you can make, you put good ingredients in, you're going to get really interesting things out.
And because I'm one of these people who's personally, I've always been a very sensitive texture person, and I just find the gelatin texture, like I don't even, like I wouldn't choose panna cotta or other kind of desserts, or I don't even really like flan, which doesn't have gelatin.
Wow. Well, but I think the texture is the appeal because it's kind of like human flesh. I mean, I know this sounds really weird, but they actually, you know, when they are testing ballistics, you know, the impact of a gun, they actually make a mold of a person out of Jell-O and shoot it into the Jell-O to see how far it'll go in.
And this is persuading us how that this is a good thing?
Well, if you like biting.
Like biting people, you're going to enjoy Jell-O. I mean, to be fair, right, people don't like to think about it. But when you eat a hamburger, you're eating flesh. So that's
right, of course. But this. I think the real appeal of Jell-O is that it does have a strange texture and it seems, and it's fun. I mean, it's fun in a way that biting in a hand to a hamburger is fun too, but this has got this bounce and jiggle and lovely sort of squishiness. And I've, you know, just sort of playing around with Jell-O, you start thinking, you know, does it bounce? does it, I found the most interesting and bizarre use for Jell-O is as a trombone mute. You put a big wad of Jell-O into the end of the bell, and you get this lovely wah, wah, wah sound. So there's a lot of things you could do with Jell-O.
Yes, that's a new one. Are you a trombonist? Is that why that's
new? I played it in high school, but I own one. And I just thought, let me see if this will work. I play the piano.
you were extremely thorough in your research of Jell-O of all purposes. Let's go back to something you mentioned at the beginning, because it's sort of the one that I get the most, which is probably the age at which I went to college and stuff, is there's like this deep connection between gelatin and booze. And I actually thought some of your most beautiful photographs were of your, you know, molds of a sort of alcoholic concoction. And is this something that goes really far back, or what do you think, how do you characterize the gelatin and booze relationship?
It does go very far back. I think the recent phenomenon of gelatin being infantilized means that they took the alcohol out. But before Jell-O brand started selling its recipes, gelatin almost always contained wine, and sometimes really interesting wine. Like if you use port or sherry or Madeira or something like that, it's got just the right enough alcohol that you can actually get a nice little buzz, but it doesn't sort of hit your palate in a way that tastes really alcoholic. Like if you were to just take straight booze, the way people used to take Everclear and add, you know, gelatin to it, it doesn't taste good at all. In fact, the way it just kind of sits there and seeps into your taste buds, it tastes really hot and unpleasant. So you have to add more sugar and you have to add more acid and basically hide that flavor. But if you're using really good alcohol, you find that it's magnificent in Jell-O form. In fact, how far does it go back? Well, Henry VIII's favorite dessert was a wine gelatin that had been turned purple with a turnsole, which is a coloring flower. And so you have this lovely, clear, purplish wine-based Jell-O. You always have this picture of Henry VIII with a big, you know, leg of something, throwing it behind his back. But this is really elegant and delightful and very delicate.
How would it be served to him?
In a glass, yeah. So that's the molds don't really become popular until, 19th century or so.
And would he use a spoon? Because yeah, it would, I mean, it would be formed, right? You can't knock it back, or you sort of did.
You know, you just spoon it out of the glass. Yeah. And what's really strange is that in periods when the reputation of gelatin goes down, I would say like the 18th century, they have special jelly glasses. And it's a little sort of, it looks sort of like an absinthe glass. It's a conical and it has a little stem on the bottom. And people used to go to these, what they call jelly houses, which is a term, which means a house of prostitution. And you go in your starched wig and you have a little glass full of gelatin. I don't know why that's associated with prostitution. Maybe it perks up your spirits or something like that. But the association is very much louche. So gelatin is, you know, you find jelly glasses in taverns and places of ill repute, but really not in restaurants when they appear.
So you're shattering all my history. So fraternities and sororities did not invent Jell-O shots.
That's right.
It's just a historic adaptation.
Exactly. But you know who does claim to have invented Jell-O shots is Tom Lehrer, who's the, you know, the singer who did the Vatican Rag and poisoning pigeons in the park. He told some reporter at one point that he was working on an army base and they said no alcohol is allowed on the base. And so they put alcohol into gelatin and passed through the garden. They just said, here, we're having dessert. This isn't alcohol. And it's not a true story. He made this up, but he sort of confirmed it to many journalists later that he actually invented the Jell-O shot, but clearly he didn't.
But the source remains unknown as far as you know?
Well, it's as early as people are making gelatin. So the first recipes are in the 14th century. So, you know, that's what I said. Why?
And do we, if you, because I do get it now, like, of course, yes, Everclear is very unpleasant to drink on its own. You put it in sweetened jelly and it becomes a pleasure and then you're drunk very fast.
Right.
Is there any difference in how you metabolize alcohol when it's in gelatin or?
Not really. No. In fact, strangely, if you know, I take one of my favorite cocktails, like an old fashioned or a Boulevardier is even better, like bourbon and Campari and vermouth, in equal parts and make it into a gelatin. And you tend to eat that quicker than you do sip the cocktail because it just tastes sweet and pleasant and it just goes down easily. And so you suddenly get hit by it very quickly.
Oh, so it's more like, yes, that's true. Like the amount you would have to like pause and like breathe out mouth fire if you were just, you know, doing shots of Everclear versus sucking down Jell-O shots. So, exactly. So it's more like it can kind of, if you're trying to get drunk, increase your rate of consumption.
Right. Right. But I think also if you add other ingredients, like I usually add dried fruits to that, it slows everything down, slows the rate of metabolization. Like if you're eating snacks with a drink, which is a good idea.
Yes, right. Of course, Italians never drink without food because they don't have a culture of like getting drunk, really.
Right.
Okay. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be back with more than you ever wanted to know about gelatin with culinary historian Ken Obala. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to culinary historian Ken Obala about his latest obsession and book, The Great Gelatin Revival. So Ken, we were talking sort of how far back and how historic gelatin is. I was curious about when it kind of, you know, you were describing that aspic is actually sort of a method of using gelatin. And when did that come about? And was it something the French invented or something the French actually borrowed and then Frenchified and canonized themselves and took credit for?
Yeah, well, I would say the French refined it. The recipe books, usually the earliest ones are more layered gelatin, so like several different colors, what they would call a lech or a leech in English. Just means like you'd have a green with parsley and the yellow with saffron and a blue with turnsol, and they'd slice it. So that, I mean, that would fit in the 50s also. But I think when you get recipes that are really complex and they're using it with savory dishes, that's really 19th century. That's the Carême onward, you know, the era where they're building these big giant molds with suspended food in it, either seafood or something else. And I think even when Julia was making it, that's the tail end of that great tradition of fancy restaurant jellos. And there's easy ways to do it and there's hard ways. I mean, you know, putting it in a mold is very hard because you've got to unmold the thing. And it's got to have structural support so it doesn't completely collapse. But the easy way to do it is you just spoon gelatin over something to give it this nice glaze. And you probably remember Julia did this to a duck. You know, she just had this duck glacé and poured it looked disgusting, but I'm sure it tasted wonderful. It was just this, like, you know, gelatin she poured over a roasted duck, which you serve cold, which is lovely. And of course it goes on top of pate. When you're making a pate, it's got a layer of aspic to keep out the bacteria. But I would say the French classic aspics, like œuf en gelée is a great example, are really delightful because the gelatin doesn't overwhelm and it's made with natural gelatin. It's not made with jello. It's you know, just unflavored jello or flavored with stock in the way that, like, you know, when you make you roast a chicken, the juices gelatinize, you know, in the pan afterwards once it gets cold. That kind of jello is really easy to make. You're just boiling things down. And, you know, I think what happened was the jello company tried to convince people that making gelatin at home was difficult and disgusting and took so much time and you'll never be able to do it. And the way they kind of sold all convenience foods is they told people now, you know, gelatin was only available to kings, but now it's democratized. Now you can buy this little packet and serve food like they used to in fancy restaurants and for the royalty, which, you know, is basically not true. You know, there are gelatins that are and aspics that are really cheap and easy to make and just use off cuts, pig's feet, things like that, that you still find in Central Europe and Germany, in Russia. Pacha is a kind of aspic that's, you know, Yiddish food. It's not very pretty because it's not clarified, but it tastes very good. Head cheese is also a kind of aspic. You know, you find that Germany and Italy, it's just pieces of cured meat that it's in this very, very thick gelatin that you can slice. But that's not fancy or expensive or anything. It's actually the cheapest food to make. So in a weird way, I think the Jell-O company kind of sold this idea that gelatin was being democratized and look how creative you can be and you're never going to disappoint your family if you serve this bright, colorful thing, because that's what people wanted in the, you know, post-war era baby boom. They wanted convenience.
Or they were taught to want it. I think, you know, I'm struck while you're talking about Jell-O of, I can remember all of these marketing campaigns, and they were they had a really good marketing team. And for people who remember, there was also Jell-O pudding, which is slightly different but related, and Bill Cosby was the spokesperson before he was disgraced, and all of these things, right? They made it compelling, and I assume they could do that because it was relatively cheap to produce, so they put a lot of money into selling a lot of it.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, the era of Cosby and Jell-O pudding and Jigglers was the company getting desperate because sales were plummeting, and they have consistently since, you know, the 70s, because fewer and fewer people want to eat artificial food. And so that's, so I think they said, okay, let's sell this to children and let's invent fun new ways that they can have, you know, play with their food. Cause basically Jigglers are for playing with and eating. The only places that didn't happen is what they call the Jell-O Belt. So it extends from Utah to Iowa. And those two states have sort of been competing in the highest consumption rate of Jell-O. Utah usually wins. And I can't explain why, but Mormons love Jell-O. It's just one of those things that, you know, keeps, and they're proud of the fact, you know, in a way that sort of casseroles.
Presumably not, and not Jell-O shots.
No, not Jell-O shots. Wholesome Jell-O. The actual Jell-O brand, you know, is what they like.
That there's a kind of fascinating parallel that I wanted to share with you that I only recently learned, actually by talking to the Pepperidge Farm people. When you were saying the Jell-O got infantilized, the same thing actually happened to Julia's favorite Goldfish crackers,
right?
Which were seemingly, most people would be like, oh, they're a kid snack that some adults like, but actually they were a cocktail food originally.
Right.
They were a Swiss cocktail treat, and then. Sort of similarly, Pepperidge Farm had this idea to sell them to kids. And, you know, I can't remember who was just writing about, actually, I do remember, it was on a political talk show. She was talking about how she just realized the smile was only recently added. And in talking to Pepperidge Farm, they've been thinking about trying to bring it back to an adult snack.
Well, yeah, I think once you've made something into children's food, it's very hard to get adults to eat it again, unless it's ironic or sarcastic, you know, or kitsch, or they're just doing it. And it's really, this is really for the kids, but they're taking, you know, my grandchildren love Goldfish, and because they're fun to eat, you know, they're just little things you pop in your mouth. But would you serve Goldfish at a really serious cocktail party? I mean, I think that's why people find the fact that Julia loved them so funny, because here she is making these elaborate things and she pulls out Goldfish, which, you know, not homemade, and who knows how they're flavored, and, you know, they're good, but still, I think so. In any case, gelatin went down that path of stuff for children and invalids and Mormons. I don't think it's going to come back. I mean, that form of Jell-O, it will have to be entirely different. And I think this is what I took on as my mission, was to make gelatin respectable again by using very nice ingredients and pushing the boundaries of what could be aesthetically pleasant and a little scary, sometimes very scary. And because people, I think, are kind of tired of the culinary aesthetic that has reigned for quite a while, has been very hyper-localized, hyper-handmade, authentic in a way that only people of certain backgrounds can make certain food because they grew up in the tradition or have that as their, you know, heritage. And I think people are just frustrated now at the point where they kind of want something entirely new, and it won't be, you know, a do-it-yourself pickles anymore. It'll be something that's fun and not too difficult and can give you sort of a blank canvas for creativity. And I think that's what gelatin really does, is you can put any flavor on earth into it, any ingredient can go into it, and they can be combined in ways that you don't have to play by the rules anymore. I think people are just kind of getting frustrated and fed up with that, you know, everything being correct and this is the proper way you make this, that gelatin's pleasant because no one can tell you, here's the, you know, this is the right way to do it, the wrong way, because there are no traditions, you know, in gelatin. I mean, there are, but we're inventing new ones, or at least I'm trying to invent new ones that will liberate people from rules.
Well, let's talk about that, because I wanted to talk to you about some of the recipes in the book, because there are a lot of them. And I thought you could highlight maybe a few that might change skeptics like me into jelly fans. What would you call out as, you know, some of the game changers?
Well, I would say my favorites are the ones that use cocktails or use really interesting wine. And in a way that you would sort of pair certain wines with certain foods. Like, let's imagine you have a lobster and you pair that with a really nice buttery wine, you know, malolactic, with vanilla notes and that sort of thing. You're not just sipping and tasting side by side, you're actually putting them on your palate at once and chewing the wine literally. And I think those have, gastronomically, I think those are just really eye-opening. I think the other thing is some ingredients that you would maybe not think of putting out as appetizers suddenly become, in this format, you can actually pick them up and serve them as an hors d'oeuvre. So I think it's sort of endless. I mean, really, that the scope for creativity doesn't begin or end anywhere. You can just throw any ingredient. And literally, this is what I did. I used to open the refrigerator, come home from work and say, oh gosh, God, I've got this rum in the cabinet. I've got some lime juice. Wouldn't a ceviche go really nicely in that? You know, because the flavors are kind of aligned. So that's really, I think, where I've the invention came in.
And what's an example of a gelatin appetizer or hors d'oeuvre?
Oh gosh, there's dozens upon dozens.
What's your favorite?
My favorite, I think, is the boulevardier. Well, I don't know whether this is in the cookbook, but take dried fruits, apricot and raisins and dates, and set them in a boulevardier and just cut bars out of it and just place them a little firmer than Jell-O, so you can actually pick it up and put it in your mouth. Those are lovely as starters.
Oh, so it's kind of a comedy. It's like an edible cocktail bite rather than
exactly.
Exactly
that.
I mean, it is food, but not like a heavy hors d'oeuvre. It's more of like a way of serving drinks as finger food.
Right, exactly.
That's neat. Well, much has been made of your celebrated lobster tail and champagne dish, which is visually striking. Does it taste good?
The lobster one tastes fantastic. I mean, how bad can lobster be? You know, you'd have to try hard to ruin it. I think the one that kind of upset people a lot was I put a whole baby octopus into I think it was ouzu. But I just, because you see this little octopus and it's frightening, or one that frightened people was a BLT that didn't have bread. It was set into a martini. So you see a layer of bacon, a layer of lettuce, a layer of tomato, really, really great tomato. And I cut it into triangles and put an olive and a toothpick on top of it. So you literally just pick up this little half sandwich and get all the flavors of a BLT, which incidentally goes wonderfully with a martini. So it, you know, looked crazy, but tasted fantastic.
But I can't get over, how do you talk to a someone skeptical like me? Because I'm like, why would you take lobster that's amazing and embedded in gelatin?
Well, I think it's just if you've had lobster 100 times and always had it grilled or always had it boiled or had it in a lobster roll, what's wrong with trying something new? just like because the texture of lobster, you know how lobster is sort of got a nice pleasant chewiness to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's soft, but it does have some bite. Well, imagine just adding to that a little bit so that you're accentuating the flavor, and then you're using champagne. So obviously that flavor is going to combine in every bite, and it just adds to the whole aesthetic experience. I would say even more so with oysters, because oysters are lovely, magnificent. But imagine if you have the drink surrounding the oyster, and when you slurp it, you're not just biting the little oyster in there, but you have this whole kind of symphony of other flavors flying around in your mouth, and something bigger to bite on than a little oyster. It just adds to it, I think.
So your approach in all these is, whether it's cocktail or savory courses or thing, is they're kind of ways of adding flavor profiles and layers that are integral in ways that are otherwise difficult or impossible to do.
That's exactly it. And making it easy and fun to eat, which is, you know, if you have a boeuf bourguignon, you've got to sit down and have it on a plate. But if you encase it in something, sort of the way that you can encase it in a pie or something like that. But if you were to put it into a jello form and you could look into it and pick it up and hold it and have, you know, a nice burgundy, I think it just adds so much more fun to the dish.
Well, let's talk about one of the book's premises too, is that you're seeing this great gelatin revival, and you were talking very eloquently about whereas Jell-O was talking to you years ago, talking to us about a democratization in a different way, you were kind of talking about seeing gelatin in this lane of people rejecting being told they need to run a whole artisan production factory in their kitchen, and this is an easier thing. Is that the future that you see for this revival, or what kind of predictions do you have with your crystal ball about gelatin's future?
Okay. Well, I think it will be like bread. You know, there's very easy bread to make, and there's really complicated bread to make that will take a long time to start to make a sourdough and to buy the right equipment. And I think gelatin is the same way. For those people who really love playing in the kitchen, I say go all the way. Use the chicken feet or the pig's feet. Make the gelatin yourself. Get fantastic wine. Make the stock. For those people who want to spend 10 minutes, buy a little packet of Knox gelatin. Throw that into your cocktail. Throw a couple of interesting things in there, cherries maybe, whatever it may be, and have fun. And I think there's, like every all cooking, there's the really, really easy way to do things, and there's the really hard way to do things. And if you learn both, then if you have the time, you can make a real stock, for example. If you don't, you buy a concentrate or something. And that's I think true of all cooking, but people have been so de-skilled that they've forgotten the really interesting way to make aspic, which is from scratch.
And is there a significant taste difference? Like, for example, if you made bread the easy way or the long way, you might get that between Knox and buying chicken feet.
Sure, there is, because obviously it tastes like the ingredient you're making it out of. The gelatin, the Knox stuff doesn't have any flavor at all. They've gotten it, taken it out. So if you make something out of meat, it will definitely taste like meat, the end.
What is Knox still made from meat? They've just perfected technique of neutralizing the flavor.
Exactly. And they take out every, impurity, and they clarify it. And I actually went, this was totally by accident, to a gelatin factory in Germany where they make the stuff that goes into gummy bears, incidentally. And it was just fascinatingly amazing, and the place that makes the sheets that are more used in professional gelatin. And I think, I don't know how they get all they remove all the fat, and they obviously remove all the impurities, and it's filtered and it's strained. And in the end, you get this absolutely pure sheet of collagen with nothing else in it. That's impossible to do at home, but you can come pretty close. You clarify it the same way you clarify a stock. But I have found that you really can't get the meat flavor out of it, if that's, unless you use in like a fruit that overpowers it and makes it disappear.
And let's talk about that for one second, just because it's so, speaking of kid food, and has been even ubiquitized into vitamins and things, gummy bears and like Haribos are gelatin plus another ingredient to give it that texture. Is that
how? No, it's just a whole lot of gelatin.
It's just gelatin and flavoring too, yep, and then molded.
That's it. Yep, exactly. So people, you know, make their own gummy bears. You just have to use two or three times the amount of gelatin. There's a whole sideline of making cannabis line jelly bears, you know, that are, you know, I've never done that, but people do that and love it.
Yes, I'm still processing that. It's the accidental consumption of that. Yeah, I was going to say it's an edible, but boy, could that go really wrong with
children. Yes, it could. Yeah.
Wow. And so I think I was going to ask you this, but I think you've sort of answered it. Is gelatin as much about art and presentation more so than eating? But I feel like which seemed like, you know, you were talking about Carême and his creations and all the French work with aspics seemed like it was kind of about the chef showing off what they could do rather than about the deliciousness of what you were eating. Do you think the future, though, is more about this intersection between deliciousness and presentation?
Well, ideally, it's both. You know, if you have something that is all about presentation and you can't eat it, like I would argue many very fancy cakes are just about presentation, and buttercream tastes gross and most white cake tastes gross. And, you know, and they're putting cardboard and, you know, wood supports inside. That's just about presentation. But I think ideally you want something that does both. You know, you don't want food that is really ugly, and gelatin can get ugly but you know, I think if you strike a balance between something looking beautiful, because we eat with our eyes first, and something that is really tasty, that's great. And I have to say, I have made things that look beautiful and did not taste so great. I didn't put them in the book. And I had things that were so delicious and looked horrible that I just couldn't put them in.
Right. We're going to stop there on the medium ground between beauty and horrid and taste. And we'll be back to hear Ken's Julia moment. Let us know what you think of today's show and your opinions about gelatin. Send us an email or a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org. Or better yet, you can also tweet us @JuliaChildJCF. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she might have inspired them in their career. Ken, what's your Julia moment?
Well, when I was very young, my mother used to put me in a high chair in front of the TV with Julia on. And, you know, this was up until the point where I went to kindergarten, I guess. And sometimes even after that, I would just, you know, come home from school and it would be cooking shows on. And I'm sure that's where my love for food came from. But I apparently, and this is, you know, what my mother told me when I was older, that I suspect I learned how to speak English from Julia, because I used to say things and my parents would make fun of me. Like I would say tomato, and they were from Brooklyn, and still, you know, it's a tomato. And so there were these weird things that I used to say that I'm almost certain I must have gotten from Julia. That one sticks in my mind especially.
Yeah, that's funny too that because you write in the book about how your parents were actually not foodies and were kind of dieting all the time or eating what was So why was she watching Julia? She found Julia entertaining.
Well, it was the thing you did. You know, you put on whatever was on TV, and I think whatever came over public TV was Julia and Graham Kerr, and you know, it was all cooking shows were on for a whole block in the afternoon. And so that's what she put on. And it wasn't that she wasn't interested in cooking. She was a terrible cook, but she did it every day, you know, because people needed to eat. So I think she looked for inspiration in those shows, even if she didn't actually cook those recipes.
Got it. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was great fun. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. To keep up with Ken, he's @KenAlbala on Instagram. It's ALBALA and @Ken.Albala on Facebook. The book is The Great Gelatin Revival. It's out now from the University of Illinois Press. Ask or search for it at your favorite bookseller. You can check out new Julia Child video clips. Well, they're actually not new clips, but they're newly available on Facebook. It's From the French Chef, and just go to at Julia Child on Facebook. You also want to make sure you're following at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. If you're not already, I'm at T. Shulkin on Instagram. A reminder, the 2023 Taste of Santa Barbara is coming up May 15 to 21. You want to follow at SB Culinary Experience on Instagram for the latest news about events in and around Santa Barbara, including a soon-to-be-announced spring pop-up. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at GBH. Thanks, as always, to my co-producer at the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Armin Spengen. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.